Lecture 33, The Household in the Polis.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. The legal code was shaped to protect the family and society. And so, as a prelude to our lectures on law, I want to take a broad look at the family and its role in the state during the period we've just covered and in the next period to come. So when I said at the end of the last lecture that court is now in session, it's not quite yet in session, but will be in our next lecture. The family is an integral part of Greek society as a whole. And it's in protecting the family that the legal code was shaped, something we'll discuss in detail in the next lectures. So in this lecture, I want to outline the relationship of the family to the polis and the role of the family in civic life, because there are some important differences between then and now. I also want to discuss the family unit, that's the members of it, what each was expected to do, what society's attitudes were to each member, and so forth. And finally, on the society side, I want to give some examples of its downsides. And these examples, I believe, put a very different perspective on it. All too often, the view of Athens, indeed of Greece, that were presented within documentaries on the Greek genius or some such, or in glossy picture books, is how grand the place was. We come away with an appreciative glow, with warm fuzzies. But the reality was very different, and I'll give you some insights and let you make up your mind on the matter towards the end of this talk. The Greek word for family or family unit was oikos. Aristotle, in his Politics, emphasized that the oikos was such an integral part of the polis that, to put it more crudely, you couldn't have a polis without oikoi, oikoi being the plural of oikos. The family, or the oikos, was far more bound up with the actual well-being and continuation of the state than it is today. And correspondingly, so also was the dependence of the state on its oikoi. There were also similarities in running the two entities, that's the oikos and the polis. Aristotle tells us this in the Politics, when he writes, and I quote, "Some thinkers believe that running a household and controlling slaves and being a politician and being a king are all the same." So only the scale then between polis and oikos is different. Aristotle defined the oikos as consisting of a husband, a wife, legitimate children, and slaves. I'd like to consider each one of these family members in turn. The head of the household was known as the Kyrios, and he was the absolute authority in that oikos. The Kyrios had three distinct duties. He had to provide the oikos with the means of sustenance, in other words, to put food on the table. He had to protect the oikos in times of war, and he had to ensure his household's standing in the eyes of the gods. This meant that the position of his wife and children was clearly marked out in the household, and that both, that's the wife and the children, both were subordinate to him. The husband then, the Kyrios, was the most overtly powerful member of the oikos, and his duty as a citizen was to provide for it and to take part in political life. However, the duties of both wives and children were still important. The wife was in charge of managing household affairs, and she had the special task of looking after slaves. Now, I'm talking here, of course, about citizen women, not about courtesans or prostitutes. The difference between the common prostitute and the courtesan, as we've said in a previous lecture, was that the prostitute was like the street corner hooker of today, and the courtesan was more of the educated, refined escort. Often she would be kept as a mistress by those wealthy enough to afford her. Now, both types of women, that's the prostitute and the courtesan, would not be citizens. And so they would have no recourse to any of the things that a citizen woman had. And even then, citizen women were not liberated like they are today. They had no political rights, and they had limited judicial rights. Not to mention a lot of limitations on what they wore when they went out in public, and even what funerals they might attend. The line of descent in the oikos passed from father to son, in other words, patrilinear descent. This seems the norm throughout the Greek world, and in fact, on the mainland at least, it goes back to the Bronze Age, the Mycenaean period. Now, there were exceptions to this rule. In Sparta, as we've already mentioned, women could inherit and own land in their own names. And on Crete, it appears that the line was matrilinear, through the mother. But these were the exceptions. They were few and far between, and they certainly didn't apply to Athens. Now, when there was not a son to inherit the oikos, the father could adopt one. Or his daughter, if he had a daughter, that is, could inherit the oikos in order to retain the family property, but then she would be expected to marry her nearest male relative, usually her uncle, and so continue that oikos line through her new husband. Marriages were arranged often for economic reasons. The grooms might see their brides in advance of the wedding. They probably did, actually. But girls had no say at all in the matter. More than that, they often didn't see their husbands until the day of the wedding. So they had no idea what he was like, what his tastes were, what his favourite colour was, whether he snored or anything like that. Athenian girls also married very young, usually around 12 or 13. But the groom was normally in his early 30s. When she married, the Athenian girl passed from the authority of her father to that of her husband, who was then responsible for completing her education as far as the household went. We have a treatise by Xenophon called the Economicus, gives us our word economics, and in this treatise, a husband called Ischomachus is talking to Socrates about the ideal wife. And along the way, Ischomachus tells us that when he married, he had to educate his wife in almost everything, including how to arrange storage jars in the family home. Now, the reason for the extreme youth of the girl was bound up with her being a virgin, because only legitimate children from a marriage could inherit the oikos. In fact, the Athenians were virtually paranoid about legitimacy, and the definition of what comprised a legitimate Athenian citizen came in 451 when Pericles introduced his citizenship law. And this law stipulated that both parents had to be citizens before offspring of that marriage was deemed legitimate. It's this concern about legitimacy that's at the heart of the Athenian law of adultery, in particular why that law has such strict and harsh penalties. Moreover, adultery was a public offence. Now that strikes us as very odd. Adultery public? Today, for example, if a couple goes through a divorce, only their family is affected. They divide up their property in whatever proportion they and the divorce lawyers agree to, unless there is a prenup, I guess. If children are involved and there's a custody battle, the parties might go to family court, and the matter essentially is a civil or private one, certainly not a public one affecting the state. But back in classical Greece, that was not the case. While divorce was an option for women, we seldom hear of wives divorcing their husbands. And we'll talk about instances of when a husband divorced his wife in a moment. As I stated before, the oikos was the foundation stone of the polis. It was bound up with the very well-being of the polis. That meant that anything that compromised the continuation of the oikos affected the community as a whole. What affected the oikos more than anything else was doubt cast on the legitimacy of the children, because bastards could not inherit the oikos and so continue the family line. Who's to say then that the children of a wife who'd had an extramarital affair were all legitimate? That's why the Athenian law of adultery was so severe and a public one, because the whole community suffered. Adulterers could be fined or suffer torture, including having their pubic hair plucked out or radishes inserted up their anus. Or if the husband returned home and caught his wife and her lover in the act, he could kill the adulterer on the spot with impunity under the law of justified homicide. And I'll talk about this law in a forthcoming lecture. As for the adulterous wife, she was automatically divorced and she couldn't attend certain state sacrifices or festivals. Now, this was a massive social stigma, far more so than today, because she would never marry again in Athens. Who would want a woman who voluntarily endangered the existence of the oikos, who didn't do her role in the oikos? If she happened to ignore this law, in other words, if she did still move around the city as a citizen woman, if she did attend these sacrifices and festivals, then anyone who saw her could inflict any punishment on her short of death. If the husband, by the way, didn't divorce his wife, he would lose his citizenship. So there is no chance whatsoever, like there is today, for a married couple that discovers that one of the others has had an adulterous relationship. There is no chance back in Athens, as there is today, of one person forgiving the other and the couple continuing to stay married. The law forbade that in Athens. The voluntary nature of the wife's crime is perhaps the reason why the Athenians regarded rape as less of a crime than seduction. And the penalty imposed on rapists was a monetary fine. Now, towards rape, we have the same attitude as the Athenians did. The woman is forcibly taken and she has no power over the situation, unlike adultery. So that's why the Athenians come down harder on the adulterous woman than on the woman who's been raped or on the rapist. Oh yes, you're probably wondering about what sort of restrictions were put on men, on the husband. Well, in a word, none. The husband, the Kyrios, was free to go out and have sex with prostitutes or courtesans, just not someone else's wife. If these, that is, if the prostitute or the courtesan, or for that matter, any other non-Athenian woman, and that includes female slaves, by the way, if these sort of women gave birth, then their children would automatically be regarded as illegitimate. They would have few social and judicial rights. The technical term for a bastard in Athenian law was nothos. By the way, society didn't preclude male citizens from any social group, upper or lower classes. It didn't preclude male citizens marrying non-citizen women. Didn't preclude them marrying prostitutes. But the marriage was not regarded as a proper one. And children from that marriage could not be Athenian citizens. The apparent male attitude to women is neatly summed up in an extract from a forensic speech in which the speaker divides women into three categories. I'd like to quote this now. Quote, living with a woman who is a man's wife means this: to have children by her and to introduce the sons to the members of the clan and of the deme and to betroth the daughters to husbands as one's own. Whores we keep for the sake of sexual pleasure. Courtesans for the daily care of our persons. But wives we keep to give us legitimate children and to be faithful guardians of our households. Now we know from court speeches, from forensic oratory, that the husband and wife lived apart in their house. The wife lived upstairs and the husband lived below, downstairs. We also know that the door to the wife's quarters could be locked, and locked from the outside. This was not so much for her own protection if the husband went out partying at nighttime or something, but it was to keep her locked in, so that an adulterer couldn't have his way with her, or for that matter, she couldn't go out and about herself, and the husband would be ignorant of that. Perhaps it's no wonder, given this attitude and the massive age difference that existed between husband and wife, that our young wife was tempted into having an affair. I mean, what does a 13-year-old girl and a 32-year-old man talk about after 10 or 15 minutes? What was social life like for the married couple? They were unlikely to have had any mutual friends. There could not have been love at the start of the marriage, but perhaps love might grow. Then again, Aristotle, that great misogynist, has this to say in his Ethics. Quote, "The love between a husband and his wife is the same as that which exists between the government and the governed. Marital bliss indeed." That's one quote from Aristotle I don't dare running past my wife, that's for sure. It's interesting, by the way, isn't it, that given this apparent male attitude to women, the Athenians were quite happy that their patron deity was a female, that's Athena. They also seem to have been quite happy that the priestess of the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi, the Pythia, was also the woman. Or that the wife of the Archon Basileus in Athens had certain important religious duties. But this is all religion, so that made it different. And we're also talking about upper-class women anyway. So let's move to the children in the family. I've already sort of touched on this subject by talking about our young girl marrying when she does and this sort of thing. But I want to look a little bit more closely now at the son and daughter. There is a sex differentiation between male and female, obviously, from the obvious one. But there's another one as well, because male children had seniority over female. The male children were expected to grow up and inherit the oikos, while the female children would marry in their very early teens, and they would move out of their home oikos into their own one. Whilst the boys would eat the normal staple food with meat from time to time, occasionally wine if the family could afford it, girls seldom ate meat, and they hardly ever drank wine with a meal, and even when they did, it would be watered down. So there are these sex differentiations then, even when it came to food. There's probably an economic explanation for this. In other words, there wasn't enough meat to go around on the few occasions the family could afford to eat meat, and so the boys would have preference because of their role in the oikos. It's easy to see, therefore, the attraction of a tyrant like Pisistratus, who introduced and revamped festivals that provided free meat and wine and entertainment for the ordinary people. No wonder they loved him. Until about the age of 7 or so, boys and girls were generally reared side by side. But after that age, they would separate, and in wealthier households, it would be the boys who received a more formal education. In Sparta, as we know, the boys entered the agoge at age 7. Now, all of this does not preclude bonds of affection between parent and child, and we have some ancient evidence that showed children were loved and needed. So, for example, the poet Theognis of Megara, writing in the middle of the 6th century BC, has this to say, quote, Happy is he that has dear children, whole-hoofed horses, hunting dogs, and friends in foreign parts. And Theognis goes on to say later on, but he that does not love children and whole-hoofed horses and dogs has never a happy heart. At the same time, however, archaeological evidence shows that child burials were common, though whether these are the product of natural deaths or exposure is hard to say. We know the exposure of children at birth was common practice in Sparta, but in rural Attica, for example, if a farmer's wife gave birth to yet another child, perhaps another daughter, and there wasn't enough food to go around, and given that male children had priority, well, the parents may have had no other option but to expose the baby, to leave the baby out to die. In fact, an argument has been made by at least one scholar that in a society such as the Greek one, with its economic problems and high death rates, that parents couldn't afford to become too attached to their children because they might grow to love them so much and then see them die that they couldn't afford that bond to develop. They were protecting themselves in some cases. The final member of the oikos, as Aristotle defines it, is the slave. Now, Aristotle describes slaves as animate tools, which tells us in a nutshell what the attitude to slavery was. And slaves were frequently physically exploited. Slaves were non-Athenian citizens, of course. They were captured in warfare, either against foreign foes or, more usually, other Greek polis. Slaves were used in economic sectors of society, such as mining, which was the most dangerous, and agriculture. And most households also had slaves in them. They were part of the oikos. Now, the line between free and unfree was harshly drawn. As I said, physical exploitation was common. But even in the case of the law courts, for a slave's testimony to be admissible in court, that slave had first to be tortured, regardless of his or her age. It therefore seems incompatible to say the slave was part of the oikos, part of the family. And yet we have this attitude to slavery at the same time. But there isn't any incompatibility here, because to the Athenians, the slave was not an actual member of the family. A slave's role in the oikos was merely economic. It was to help the oikos run smoothly. The slave might do the shopping. He might do chores around the house. And although the mistress had the job of tending slaves that fell ill, this had nothing to do with the slave's actual welfare, but so that the slaves would get well sooner, get back on their feet, and so start working in the oikos again. So there is then another side to the coin of Athenian society that puts a different light on it. And it gets worse. Now, I admit that what I'm going to talk about next stems from our own Western values and traditions. We need to avoid value judgments and the like when we look at ancient societies. But sometimes, since we're only human after all, it's impossible not to make these judgments. To begin with, there's the obvious inconsistency between the Athenians calling their political system a democracy, yet they did not allow women to vote or even represent themselves in court. They segregated women in their society. They weren't secluded in some oriental fashion, but nevertheless, although women were citizens, they couldn't vote, they could be locked up in their bedrooms at night, and they had to be represented by their nearest male relatives in court. They also couldn't own land, except in places like Sparta and Crete. So clearly then, the Athenian woman has less rights than in other ancient societies like the Roman. It wasn't just the Athenians that condoned slavery, moving on to that topic, but also all Greeks. Greece was a slave-based economy, and in democratic polis, so not just Athens, slave labor allowed the male citizens the leisure time to take part in political life. And slave labor also generated the revenue for state pay, that allowed citizens to perform various paid political duties, like going on embassies or attending an assembly or being a juror. Probably where we might give up on trying to understand the mores of Greek society and ours is when it comes to children. I've already mentioned that in Athens, girls as young as 12 or 13 were getting married, presumably becoming pregnant the next year. Never mind the relationship they had with their husbands, how successfully could they have coped with pregnancy and childbirth at that age? We hear that the Spartans were different in believing that their females should be in their late teens when they got married because they could handle pregnancy and childbirth more successfully. To me, this implies a high mortality rate elsewhere. Mind you, the sons of households must have had their own traumas to deal with. In our lectures on Sparta, we talked about the institutionalized homosexuality that was a product of living in a syzygium. But boys didn't have to be Spartans to be pursued by older men. Theognis, the poet we mentioned before, has this line that speaks volumes, and I quote, "My boy, as long as your cheek is smooth, I will never stop courting you. No, not if I have to die." In a prosecution speech of the early 4th century, an older man has made a fool of himself chasing after a young boy. But as he says to the jury in his defense, "I can't help it." He says, and I quote here, "If you consider my attitude towards the boy too senseless given my age, I ask you, don't think the worst of me for that, because you know all men can't help desire." It was common for a father to broker a relationship between his young son and a man from another oikos, usually in his 20s or so. The older man would be something of a mentor. The two would hang out together, that's the older man and the son. They would hang out together, they would become friends, and then the relationship changed to a sexual one. As long as there wasn't lust from the word go, sex between the young boy, that's the son, and the older man was condoned by the boy's father. Worse, though, by our standards, was the existence of child prostitution. Now, this is found in many ancient societies, but it seems especially common throughout Greece. Girls as young as 9 or 10 were taken into brothels by madams, trained in sex, and put to work. And they were the lucky ones compared to the girls who worked the streets, because those in brothels at least had their living and working conditions somewhat monitored, and they had a roof over their heads and a bed to sleep in, so to speak. By the time they were in their mid to late teens, they were considered past it, and if they had not persuaded a rich client to buy their freedom, they were thrown out onto the streets to fend for themselves. As I said, these unsavory aspects of Athenian society admittedly stem from the values we have based on our Western upbringing, on our morality. But they need to be said, especially as they're often glossed over. We would be doing ourselves a disservice in wanting to know about the past if we edited out things that we found unpalatable or things that ran counter to an image that we want to have. Beneath this intellectual, literary, or artistic achievement of the Greeks as a whole, there was a seedy reality to their society, a reality that raises the question whether these achievements outweigh what to us are massive downsides. We've discussed how family life then and now is different to an extent, and how society's expectations of families also differed. The belief that the oikos was like a building block of the polis is not as widely held today. No one, I would say, believes that if a family today disintegrates or decides not to be religious anymore or something like that, that the state as a whole is going to suffer. But the Greeks did believe this. If, for example, a Kyrios didn't maintain his family's standing in the eyes of the gods, then those gods could direct their wrath on the entire state, on the whole polis. I'd even say then that the oikos was the microcosmic version of the state, of the polis, and that the polis was the macrocosmic version of the oikos. And the oikos goes a long way to explaining how and why the Greeks lived their lives as they did. It also shapes the development of the law code. And in our next lectures, we turn to discuss law and society in detail. Thank you very much.